No, he roots
hat. Yeah. Rabbi Ben Sabern. Yeah, we used to tease him like that. What happened to your hand? Good. Good. Oh my. I had a job where I worked 8 hours a day on a table saw and radio arm saw with real small pieces of wood. I mean, just, I know. I just, every single day, it's like I was on my tiptoes. Just on my tiptoes. We had big barrels we had to fill with these little parts just all day long. All day long, talking about a boring job. I mean, no variation, just every day the same. Yeah, right, really. Yeah, right, really. Okay, we're going to begin the book of Daniel today. Now, in the book of Daniel, in the evening class, we're several hours ahead of where we are here. And so what we might end up doing, we might end up just offering to you the evening classes that are available if we don't make it fully through the book of Daniel. I'll try to do the best I can in the morning class. But I don't want to do violence to the book, but we've got a substantial more amount of time in the evening, so we'll make that available to you. And the schedule is a lot more comfortable in the evening class. We've been constantly trying to stay up with the evening class, and it's been very, very difficult because of different days we've missed and so forth. So let's start the book of Daniel today. Daniel is the fourth of the major prophets in the Old Testament. There are four of them, of course, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Isaiah speaks of the salvation of the Lord. That's his entire heartbeat. He's called a messianic prophet of the Old Testament. He talks more about Messiah than any of the other Old Testament prophets. So Isaiah is the salvation of the Lord. Jeremiah, his message is the judgment of the Lord. And basically, about 90% of Jeremiah's message was one of judgment. Ezekiel, well, that brother, his head was in the clouds, and his message was the glory of Yahweh, or the glory of the Lord. And that's what he spent a lot of time talking about. Now, he also talked about the judgment of God, and how God's judgment would remove the glory of God from the land, but eventually God's glory returned to fill the millennial temple. Now, Daniel speaks of the kingdom of the Lord. And there's a real emphasis on the kingdom of Messiah that's going to be established on this earth. Now, the book of Daniel is easily divided into two sections. Chapters 1 through 6 is a historical section. Deals primarily, though not exclusively, with historical events. There are a couple prophetic portions in there, but the brunt of it is concerned with historical subjects. For example, let me tell you what's in each chapter, and you don't necessarily have to write it down. You can look at the top of your King James Bible for each chapter. It will tell you. But in chapter 1, we see the preparation of God's servant, Daniel, being prepared of God. In chapter 2, there's a vision of a great image that Nebuchadnezzar received from God. And we're going to look and analyze that vision of that image. Very interesting dream. Chapter 3, the golden image of Nebuchadnezzar, in which he demanded that everyone bow down and worship. That's chapter 3. Then in chapter 4, there's a vision of a great tree. And again, Nebuchadnezzar sees this, I believe, in a dream, and it's cut down, and it symbolizes his kingdom being removed from him for a period of 7 times passing over him. And then in chapter 5, a picture of the mysterious handwriting that occurs on the wall, much to the dismay of Belshazzar. Chapter 5 there. And then chapter 6, Brother Daniel in the lion's den. That's not the place you want to spend an evening. If you have a choice, pick Motel 6 or something like that, but not the lion's den. Chapter 6, unless you're high in faith. And then the second division is a prophetical section. That's chapters 7 through 12. Now this section is what we want to slow down and talk a little bit more about. It is prophetical in nature. It has some marvelous prophecies that relate to the end time. Chapter 7 deals with the world empires and a little horn. There's a real focus on this little horn. We're going to see it's going to be a prophecy of the Antichrist. In chapter 8, there's a vision of a ram and a goat. And the ram represents Medo-Persia, and the goat represents Greece. Chapter 8. Then in chapter 9, the amazing prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel. Chapter 9. Then in chapter 10, there's a delay to the prayer of Daniel, and God gives us insight into the spiritual realm to see why his prayer was delayed. It wasn't because God didn't want to answer it. It was because it was being contested by the devil. And then in chapter 11, is a picture of the wars between two groups of people that actually were descendants of Alexander the Great's empire, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And I'll talk more about them later. And there's constant warfare between them, and it had a real impact on the land of Palestine because the Seleucid Empire was to the north of Palestine, the Ptolemies, their empire was to the south, Palestine was in the middle, and so very often Palestine fell to the one or the other. And then it goes far beyond that war, and it looks at the Antichrist under the figure of Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll see that in chapter 11. And then chapter 12, a vision of the time of the end, what God is going to do for Israel at the very time of the end, chapter 12. Now, the theme of the book of Daniel is to show the sovereignty of Yahweh, to show how that Yahweh is sovereign over every single other power, and to show that the success of all the world powers, they're just temporary. And in fact, they're so temporary and so short-lived that God actually tells us about them before they even come to pass. And that just shows the power of God over them. It shows us that God is allowing them, God is using them as tools to bring about Messiah's kingdom. But nothing's out of control, everything is according to the plan of God, and God sees everything, the beginning from the end. And right along with this theme, we see that the kingdom of Jesus Christ is going to finally triumph over every single Gentile power. It's going to triumph over them all, and so sometimes the book is referred to as the Apocalypse of the Old Testament. Now, you could draw a little timeline real simply on the board like this that illustrates this theme of the book of Daniel. And you could begin with where Daniel begins, with the earthly kings of Judah. The earthly kings, and we see the kingdom of Israel established on the earth up until 605 B.C. And in 605 B.C., Judah fell to Babylon. Now realize the northern ten tribes were carried off by Assyria way back in 722 B.C., so they're not even in the picture in the book of Daniel. But in 605 B.C., Judah fell, and that marked the end of the earthly kings over Israel and Judah. There were no longer any earthly kings reigning over them. In fact, even when they came back into the land again, still there were no kings ruling over them. And then we enter a long period of time, a time of Gentile supremacy, starting in 605 B.C. Now, when we mean Gentile, we're just simply talking about the nations that are non-Jew, and Gentile supremacy, and you can see Luke chapter 21, and in Luke 21, verse 24, Jesus talked about the times of the Gentiles. He talked about how that Jerusalem is going to be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, the times of the Gentiles begins with the Babylonian captivity in 605 B.C. and extends all the way down to the second coming of Jesus. That's all the way down here. Of course, we have really a question mark here. We don't know when the second coming is going to occur. The second coming, and Israel is going to be restored as a nation at the second coming. And once again, they have a king over them, but this time the king of kings is ruling over them now. And Israel is restored again as a great nation in the earth, and the entire earth is going to be under their power and under their control. That's really what Daniel dealt with. The future Gentile powers, the time of Gentile supremacy that were ordained of God to come to power, and they would have to rule over the Jews. And so Daniel was really written then to encourage the exiled Jews as they were there in Babylon, and to show them that God's sovereign program for Israel was a time of Gentile domination, that the Gentiles would rule over them. And this period of time was not going to be permanent, that God eventually would come and God would establish the Messianic kingdom. The Messianic kingdom is going to last forever. And so Daniel is repeatedly emphasizing the sovereignty and the power of God over human affairs. Now let's talk briefly about the personal history of Daniel himself. Prophet Daniel is unquestionably one of the most remarkable men in the Bible and Jewish history. He's the son of the royal line of Judah, had royal blood flowing in him. I don't think he was a direct son of any of the kings, but he was apparently of the princely line. He had royal blood flowing in him. He was deported to Babylon in 605 B.C., as we're going to see in a few minutes. In 605 B.C., as a prisoner of King Nebuchadnezzar. And you can see Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 3 for that. Daniel 1, 1 through 3. He became a close advisor to the King Nebuchadnezzar and a prominent part in the Babylonian Empire and then later on in the Persian Empire. And even though he was surrounded by the corruption of the court life, surrounded by Babylon, he always kept himself separated unto the Lord. You don't read about any sins of Daniel in this book. You don't read about any mistakes. You don't read about God correcting him. Now, there is a time in which he prayed in behalf of all of Israel, and he said, Lord, forgive us of our sins. But basically, he's portrayed as a very virtuous, very righteous, very holy man. We find that he lived through 70 years of Babylonian captivity, spending his entire life, it appears, in the glamorous city of Babylon, serving flawlessly as a prime minister under five Babylonian rulers, starting with Nebuchadnezzar, going on with a king called Merodach, and Nergal-Sarnessar, and Nabonidus, and then ending up with Belshazzar. So throughout the entire period of Babylonian domination. And then he lived on into the time of the Persian Empire as well, and also served as a prime minister underneath the Persian kings up to that point in time. And then when the Jews eventually returned to the land again in 536 B.C., Daniel just pretty much disappears from the picture, and his work and his ministry draw to a halt as far as we know. Now, the meaning of the name Daniel, I think, is noteworthy. The name Daniel means God is my judge. God is my judge. In other words, man was not his judge. God was his judge. He lived before God, and he did not live before man. I tell you, his words were often poignant. His words were often punctuated with salt and pepper, as it were. He spoke without fear or favor of man. He told Nebuchadnezzar exactly what was going to happen to him. He told Belshazzar exactly what was going to happen to him. He told the Persian kings the same thing. And he said many things to these kings that normally they would have locked your head off for, saying something like that. You know, that your kingdom's going to fall and you're going to be carried away captive or something. And yet he said that because he stood before God and not before men. That's exactly how the Apostle Paul lived as well. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4:3, but with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged of you, you Corinthians, and that's what they were doing, criticizing him, judging him behind his back. Paul says, it's a very little thing that I be judged of you or of man's judgment, yea, I judge not mine own self. And what Paul was really saying is that God is my judge. I stand before God, I live before God. So your opinion of what you think of me, that doesn't really weigh big on my heart because God is my judge. And the same with Daniel here. And so to summarize Daniel, then he's portrayed as a great man of faith, piety, humility, and dependence upon God. Now let me give you chronological background behind the book of Daniel. Here's your history lesson for the day. You all love history, so here it is. Let me talk about the five last kings of Judah here. I'll write their names down on the board. Josiah. These are all obviously B.C., so I won't write it down. And the equal sign is the number of years they actually reigned. Josiah was one king. Secondly, Jehoahaz. He was short-lived, 3 months, and he was out. Number three, Jehoiakim. From 609 to 598, and he reigned for 11
years. And then number four, Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim reigned from about 598 B.C. to 598 B.C. 3 months again, and he was out. Then one final king, Zedekiah, also called Madonai in the Bible. Realize that several of these kings have at least two names given to them in the Bible. Various conquerors would change their name, and sometimes they would change their name when they started to rule. So what I'd like to do briefly is kind of draw a picture of the closing years of Judah for you, because that's the real setting that the book of Daniel opens up with. So it was a real tumultuous period of time, a real judgment, you might say, in the land of Judah. So let's talk about this. It begins with Josiah, J-O-S-I-A-H, reigning from 640 to 609, 31 years. Jehoahaz, J-E-H-O-A-H-A-Z, 609 B.C., reigned 3 months. Thirdly, it goes to Jehoiakim, J-E-H-O-I-A-K-I-M, 609 to 598, reigning 11 years. Number four, Jehoiakim, J-E-H-O-I-A-C-H-I-N, 598 B.C., 3 months. And ending up with number five, Zedekiah, Z-E-D-E-K-I-A-H, from 598 to 586, reigning 11 years. So let's back up. Let me say something briefly about each one of these kings so you can understand the background. Number one, it begins with Josiah. Josiah was a godly king. He was a righteous man. He spearheaded the last real great revival in Judah. He sought God from a young age. He had a tender heart before the Lord. The book of the law was found in the temple in the 18th year of his reign, and when he saw how far out of kilter Judah was as far as not aligning fully with God's law, he actually brought a great revival, and the cry was back to the law, back to the word of God. But unfortunately, Josiah was killed in 609 B.C. in a battle against Pharaoh Necho, who was a king of Egypt, and Josiah was killed at Megiddo. It was a real tragic time, real unfortunate event for Judah. And the reason why is because Josiah's son, Jehoahaz, came to power. And Jehoahaz was chosen as the successor of Josiah. He's also called Shalom in the Bible. He only reigned for about 3 months, and Pharaoh Necho came. And Pharaoh Necho, that's spelled N-E-C-H-O, not Nickel, but Necho. And Pharaoh Necho came to power, as it were, I should say came up to Judah, and removed Jehoahaz from power after only a three-month reign. And thirdly, that brings us to Jehoahaz's brother, and that's Eliakim or Jehoiakim. And it was actually Necho that installed number three, Jehoiakim, there in power. And he was a greedy, unprincipled man. He was a wicked man. In fact, he burned a scroll of Jeremiah's prophecies of the coming judgment. He didn't like what Jeremiah was prophesying about. He needed to hear that, but it did not tickle his ears like the false prophets did. And so, just to show you how unprincipled he was, he actually took the scrolls of Jeremiah, cut them with a penknife, and threw them into the fire. Well, he reigned for about 11 years, and then he was bound in fetters to be taken to Babylon with the vessels from the temple. And that's talked about in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, 5 through 7. 2 Chronicles 36, 5 through 7. However, he did not actually make it to Babylon because he died and was buried right outside the gates of Jerusalem, and his burial was that of an ass. Jeremiah had prophesied this in Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah 22:19 says that he will have the burial of a donkey dragged away and thrown outside the gates of Jerusalem. So basically, just like the Jews would have treated a donkey carcass by taking it, throwing it outside the walls, letting it rot, that's basically what they did with this king. Threw him outside the walls just like a dead donkey. And that was prophesied of, I'm sure, part of his judgment. Nebuchadnezzar's original intention was, though, to take him back to Babylon. He never made it. And then number four, his son Jehoiakim, also known in the Bible as Jeconiah, also a very wicked king, came to power, reigned for only 3 months. About 3 months. And what happened is that Nebuchadnezzar again came against Jerusalem in 598 B.C., and he took the main captives away captive, many noblemen, many skilled craftsmen. And when he did that, he also took Jeconiah and I should say, yeah, Jeconiah or Jehoiakim. And he took him prisoner to Babylon for about 37 years and then finally released him. And so he only reigned for about 3 months. He was barely really even beginning his reign before he was taken captive. And that's seen in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 10. And also 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 27. And then Nebuchadnezzar made his uncle, that is the uncle of Jehoiakim, he made his uncle the next king, that is Mattaniah or Zedekiah. And Zedekiah came to power. And he was actually the direct son of Josiah and the brother of Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. And Zedekiah made an oath of alliance to Nebuchadnezzar, and that's how he stayed in power for about 9 years. But after a 9-year pact with Nebuchadnezzar, he broke it for a period of 2 years, and I think he actually made agreements with Egypt and other powers, and eventually Nebuchadnezzar came down, and he besieged the city for 2 years, and Jerusalem fell in the 11th year of Zedekiah, fell to the power of the Babylonians, and the city and the temple were destroyed, fell down to the ground, pretty much. The sons of Zedekiah were slain right before Zedekiah, and the eyes of Zedekiah were punctured, and he was carried away to Babylon. And that's how the kings end in the book of Kings. And that's 2 Kings chapter 24 and chapter 25. 2 Kings 24 and chapter 25. Now let me talk briefly about the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. As you know, it occurred in three stages, three distinct periods of time. The first wave of captivity occurred in 605 B.C. And in 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar defeated the Egyptians and the Assyrians at the Battle of Carchemish, and then moved down into Palestine, began to prey on Palestine. And this occurred in the third year of Jehoiakim, which is the third king up there, in the third year of his reign. And Nebuchadnezzar took captives of nobility and also some of the vessels from the temple. He took them back to Babylon. Well, Daniel was a young lad during this time. Daniel was taken back to Babylon in this first wave of captivity, along with his companions. Then there was a second wave, and that occurred in 598 B.C. And in 598 B.C., the second wave, of course, it was spearheaded by Nebuchadnezzar. The Babylonians came down against Judah again, and this time there was a larger deportation during the reign of Jehoiakim, and that would be number four. And this time there were 10,000 noblemen that were taken captive, also the men of valor, the craftsmen, and basically only the poorest of the land were left behind. And many noblemen were taken. Great numbers of the Jews were taken. This was the second stage of captivity, and with that you can see 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings 24. And then the final wave of captivity occurred in 586 B.C. That'd be the third wave. And in this final stage and third wave, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed. The walls were broken down. Zedekiah was taken captive. And with this, we have the complete collapse of the kingdom of Judah. Judah is no longer in existence. But just realize now that the 70-year captivity begins with the first date of 605 and the first wave of Babylonian captivity. Okay, let's turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 1, and let's start reading in verse 1. Read about this godly king, or I should say godly man called Daniel, an ungodly king called Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, onto Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, this would be in about the year 605 B.C. After Jehoiakim had rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, he came down against the land. Now, over 100 years prior to this very event, Isaiah had actually foretold of this day. So the Jews had like 100 years of warning, and it was insufficient. They still had not been listening to God. And you can read of that in Isaiah chapter 38, verses 4 through 7. Isaiah 38, 4 through 7. As we mentioned, this was the first of three major attacks against Judah. And in this first onslaught, Nebuchadnezzar carried off Daniel and his three companions. Verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. So what we need to see is that God is behind this event in history. God is allowing it. It was not that Nebuchadnezzar was so powerful he just overpowered the Jews. If they would have been walking with God, Nebuchadnezzar could have never overcame them. But God allowed it to happen. Now, it says here that they were carried to the land of Shinar, these captives. Now, Shinar is the area of Babylonia. The area of Babylonia, or Babylon, which is the region of lower Mesopotamia, right above the Persian Gulf. And Babylon was the main city of Babylonia. So Babylon was the name of the capital, and then often the country itself is called Babylon. This is the same country that's talked about in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10. Genesis chapter 10, verse 10. Babylon is also the location of the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was built here in this very region after the flood. Now, often you'll read also in the Bible or in history books about the land of the Chaldeans. And that's talking about the same region, the land of the Chaldeans. Now, what Nebuchadnezzar did, he stole these vessels from the temple and he took them back to Babylon. Many of them were made out of gold. Many were made out of silver. Many were made out of brass. They were extremely valuable, very precious. They had been made by Solomon. And it included things like drinking containers and things for offering incense before Yahweh and for carrying the blood into the holy place and holy of holies and many, many very valuable items that were carried. And Nebuchadnezzar took them into his house built to his god, probably the god Bel, B-E-L. And that's where they remained for a number of years. And in fact, later on, one of his descendants, Belshazzar, is going to use them to drink wine out of, as we're going to see in chapter 5. Well, verse 3. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored. Now, what Nebuchadnezzar is doing, he's surveying everyone that's taken captive. Now, they took only the cream of the crop at this point in time. And there was a real custom amongst the ancient rulers to have foreign people ruling in their courts. They were called courtiers. And so it was a real common custom to take like the Israelites and to have them reigning right there with this Babylonian king and waiting at the beck of every commandment that Nebuchadnezzar might give. And so what Nebuchadnezzar is saying, he's addressing this man called Ashpenaz, and he's saying, now you look over all the captives, and I want you to take a handful of these Israelites. And they need to be of the king's seed. They need to be princes. They need to be of royal blood, royal extraction. And they need to have a certain type of regal bearing about them. And I want you to train them for me, and they're going to stand in my court. I'm going to select from even amongst them, and I want them to wait on me. That's basically what he is saying here. So in verse 3, what we learn then is that Daniel, apparently, and his three companions were apparently of royal blood. Although I do not think that they were directly the sons of, like, say, for example, King Zedekiah, because all of Zedekiah's sons were slain. But they did have royal blood in them. Okay, verse 4. These were to be children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. Now, there were several requirements that Ashpenaz had to keep in mind when he selected this young little group of men. Number one, they were to have no blemish. And that means there was to be no defect. It speaks primarily of their physical features. There were to be no defects in their physical appearance. They were to be very handsome. They were to be without any physical handicaps and to be very healthy. Now realize when the Bible says children, this Hebrew word for child or children can actually mean a boy, anyone up to like 12 or 14 years of age. So Daniel isn't necessarily like a child, 2 or 3 years old, crawling around on all fours. In fact, as we read on here, obviously he's a young teenager, probably. However, he couldn't have been too old because we find him still ministering 70 years later. So obviously, he probably is a young teenager, maybe 12, 13, or 14 years of age here. Now also in verse 4, they were to be well-favored. That has the idea of good-looking, pleasing in appearance. They were to be skillful in all wisdom. That is, they were to be intelligent children, very perceptive children. And they were to be cunning in knowledge and understanding science. That really means they are to be possessed of knowledge and able to impart instruction. The idea that they have knowledge and able to teach others. And it refers apparently to their mental ability. So the idea is that not only did he want them to be handsome, but also intelligent, quick of mind, able to learn well. And there was also another requirement. They needed to have the ability to stand in the king's palace. It has the idea that they needed to have the type of personality that enabled them to live in the royal courts. They needed to have a certain type of dignity and nobility about them. And they needed to have the proper manners and the poise and the confidence. And I know I'd feel very, very out of place in a place like that. If you were to come to my house and just, you know, at any given time of the day, I'd probably have jeans on and a flannel shirt and moccasins on or something. I mean, that's what I feel comfortable with, really. You know, but I would not feel comfortable over with the Queen of England. I wouldn't know what to eat. I wouldn't know how to really carry myself. And I don't really desire to know, to tell the truth with about the whole matter. And so I would not really be a likely candidate for this position, probably. They'd probably pass me right over. Now also in verse 4, it goes on and it says, whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Now the Chaldeans were the select tribe of the land of Babylonia. Babylon and Babylonia started off with basically one family tribe. They were the family of the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans became the prominent tribe, the most powerful tribe, and hence that's why we often call the nation of Babylon or Babylonia the land of the Chaldeans. But more specifically now, in the book of Daniel, the term Chaldeans refers to a special little select caste of magicians and holy men and astrologers there in the land of Babylonia. So kind of what it's like saying is that this was a select group of royal advisors to Nebuchadnezzar himself. And that's basically what he was looking for, someone that they could train, that there were foreigners, but they could bring them up into this very elite little group of Chaldeans. Okay, well, verse 5. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now, what Nebuchadnezzar did, he set before them the very food that he himself ate. Set before them all the delicacies of the food and the wine and the rich food, set it before them, and he gave them a time period now, 3 years. For 3 years he's going to feed them like this so that they might be trained and come into the things of Babylonia. And so they're actually supported now during the entire time of their education and training for the court. Well, Daniel happens to be numbered amongst them, as well as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Let me read you verse 6 and 7. Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and of Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. Well, it's interesting when you look at these names, let me tell you what they mean. Daniel means God is my judge. We've already mentioned that. Hananiah in verse 6 means Yahweh is gracious. Yahweh is gracious. It didn't look like it right now. They were in captivity. But really, apparently Hananiah saw behind the affairs that were going on, and he still knew Yahweh is the gracious God. Mishael, his name means who is what God is. Mishael means who is what God is. And Azariah means Yahweh helps. Yahweh helps. God was their strength there in Babylon. Azariah, Yahweh helps. Now the Babylonians changed their names. Important to realize that Daniel didn't change his name. It was the Babylonians that began to call them these names. And Daniel, his name was changed to Belteshazzar. And that means may Bel protect his life. Bel, B-E-L. May Bel protect his life. Hananiah's name was changed to Shadrach, which means command of Aku. Aku is spelled A-K-U. Shadrach, command of Aku. Aku was the moon god. They had several different gods. They had actually a pantheon, several different nature gods and so forth. Mishael, his name was changed to Meshach. It means, who is what Aku is? See, his name had been, who is what God is, and they changed it to, who is what Aku is. And then finally, Azariah, his name was changed to Abednego. It means servant of Nebo. N-E-B-O. Nebo was kind of one of the prominent gods there. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar was named after Nebo. Hence, you get the word Nebu. See? N-E-B-O. And really what the Babylonians were trying to do here, they were trying to obliterate the knowledge of the true God. They were trying to reorient their entire lives now, remove them from the religion, remove every reminder of God. And you know, that's exactly what the devil will try to do. He'll try to rename you. He'll try to reassociate you. He'll try to get you to eat the king's meat, eat the meat of Babylon rather than the meat of the Word of God. He'll try to reorient your entire thinking, get you entrenched in Babylon. But we find that these four young men were not about to follow this program. Look at verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now literally this means, when it says Daniel purposed in his heart, it's saying that Daniel placed it upon his heart. Or it's saying that Daniel laid it upon his heart. This was a real concern to young Daniel. He laid it upon his heart. He was praying before Yahweh, and it was a great decision. It was not a light-handed type of decision that kids sometimes make off the cuff, tongue-in-cheek type thing. This was a real sobering type decision. And he said, I will not defile myself with the meat that the king has to offer me. Now, why did he not want to eat the meat of the king? Well, you know what kings eat. They eat things like snails and, you know, how these rich people, the food that they eat, I have no desire to eat that. When I see a snail or a slug, I don't care if you boil it and pepper it, I'm still not going to eat it. If that's royalty, give me poverty. I don't want it. I don't want any type of that food. But probably the reason why they wouldn't eat it, probably a lot of the foods were unclean. Probably. That's one point right there. And also, according to many authorities, the Babylonians had a custom of offering their foods to idols. And you say, well, Paul said food offered to an idol is nothing. Yes, but they were not living in the days of New Testament liberty. They were living back in the Old Testament, and Yahweh had commanded them very carefully to not eat, not partake of the ways of the heathen, and they weren't living in the times of New Testament liberty, and so it was a very serious thing. Even the wines, in fact, were dedicated to the gods. And on top of that, wine is often associated with joy and gladness, and this was not a time of joy and gladness for Daniel and his companions. And so they just decided they were not going to partake of this king's meat. Now, there's a real lesson here, and that's this, is that Daniel could not avoid his captivity. It was Yahweh's will, in fact, that the Jews go captive. He could not avoid his confinement, but he could refuse to compromise. He could refuse to say yes to Babylon, even though he was in Babylon. And that's exactly what he did. Now, you cannot help the fact that you're here on this old terra firma, the earth. You can't help that fact. A lot of you can't help the fact that you're now working maybe in an ungodly environment. Maybe they're playing rock music. And maybe you're looking for another job, but that's about it for right now. And you've got to work. And maybe the situation is not perfect. But one thing you can do is purpose not to defile yourself, like Daniel did. And God can keep you during this time. Now, I don't think Daniel really saw the full significance of this decision at this point in time. I don't think he really knew where this was going to lead to. But I'll tell you this, there were a number of other young men that were Israelites that did not make this stand and were not used by God the way Daniel was. And Daniel made this stand on a seemingly insignificant issue, and God used him in a powerful way. One author puts it like this, quote, had Daniel compromised with the word of God, trifled with his convictions, and tinkered with his conscience, either for personal safety or for political preferment, pomp or power, he never could have been the channel through whom God poured forth his truth to kings and kingdoms, both past and present. God was preparing this young man for future revelations of his word and will. Daniel was more concerned about the smile of God than the hand claps of the giddy and godless crowd, end quote. And my point is this, is that right now God might be dealing with seemingly insignificant areas in your life. You never know what that's going to lead to, though. if you give in and if you succumb to those things and yield to those things, and you know, it doesn't matter if I cheat a little bit on my income tax and everything, God is shaking his head and he's saying, oh, it matters a great deal.
That's right.
Because you're going to be my future channel of revelation, and if you yield now and if you defile yourself now and if you don't lay these things on your heart, if you don't purpose in your heart right now, then I will not be able to flow through you the way that I really desire. And so that's really an important lesson here. Well, verse 9, God saw the whole situation. He always does. He always makes a way where there is no way. And in verse 9, it says, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. All of a sudden, this eunuch found himself loving Daniel. He didn't know why. God knew why, though. You see, the Bible talks about God, the hearts of the king are in the hands of God, and he turns them whatever way he desires. And this prince all of a sudden just took a liking to Daniel. Maybe didn't even know why. Maybe had never even considered why. But there was a reason for it. God put it in his heart. And the point is that God began to honor Daniel because of his commitment. God began to work even in the heart of an unbeliever, even on the part of a Gentile, because of the dedication and the consecration that Daniel had made. Daniel said, I'm going to keep a pure conscience, void of offense toward God and man. And so God vindicated Daniel. God honored him. Then verse 10. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, that is, I fear Nebuchadnezzar, who hath appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse liking? That's Old English for sadder. Why should he see your faces sadder than children which are of your sort? The word sort means age, children of your age. Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. In other words, it was his responsibility to nurture these children, bring them up in the ways of the Babylonians, feed them with good food of the Babylonians. He's worried now. Nebuchadnezzar was not a particularly compassionate man. When you read about him, he was a terrible oriental despot. He was capable of all kinds of fiendish cruelties. For example, he slew the sons of Zedekiah right before the eyes of Zedekiah and then pierced the eyes of Zedekiah. He threw some of his chief officers into the furnace to watch them burn to death. He roasted his victims alive in a slow fire, often skewered them and roasted them alive in a slow fire. That's the type of man he was. And Nebuchadnezzar had told Ashpenaz, that you raise these men properly. And all of a sudden Daniel is saying, nothing doing. I'm not going to eat that food. I'm not going to eat that meat. And of course the eunuch is thinking, well, he's going to get skinny. And he's going to look sad in his face. So verse 11. Then said Daniel to Melzar. Now Melzar was underneath the prince of the eunuchs. He was, actually the word Melzar means a steward here. So he evidently was directly below the prince of the eunuchs. Probably directly responsible to Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Probably their personal tutor to teach them the Chaldean language as well. But then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Now, pulse, and that doesn't sound real good, does it? Get up in the morning, 5 a.m, and eat pulse. Doesn't sound too good. Really, what pulse means is simply vegetables growing from seed. It's just simply talking about stew, basically, without meat in it. So it's like vegetables. And what Daniel is saying is, you just feed us vegetables. You feed us vegetable stew with grains in it. You just test us for 10 days. You prove us for 10 days. And really, it's a creative solution to a very sticky, thorny problem here. And I want you to notice that Daniel did not immediately defy the authorities over him. He sought a real congenial way to pacify the authorities. He struck up a godly compromise, if you will. He's offering them a compromise here in the right way. And he's saying, you just test us for 10 days, and there's not going to be that noticeable of a change in us. And then see, if it doesn't work out after 10 days, then we'll think about something else. And the point is that if you're in a secular job or a job of employment somewhere or some other situation, and the authorities over you have you do something that you don't feel like you can do, try to seek a creative way without compromising first. Don't instantly defy them. Don't take a self-righteous type attitude, well, bless God, and then, you know, go on and defy them. But try to seek some way that you can effect a real compromise, see. As much as lieth within you, live peaceably with all men. Well, look at verse 13. Chapter 1, verse 13. I guess I read that. Didn't I read that, maybe? Okay. verse 13, it says, "Then let our countenance be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants." Now, as I mentioned, there were other children in Israel that did not purpose this in their heart. And we gather that from, verse 3, I suppose, would be the verse that would indicate that. And the point is that Daniel made a real commitment before God here. Many Israelites were there that did not make the same commandment. And look at the result of Daniel's commitment, verse 14 and 15. "So he," that is Melzar, directly under Ashpenaz, "consented to them in the matter and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat." Well, this is saying that when you adhere to the will of God, God is not going to allow you to be found wanting. God-honoring convictions are always going to yield God-honoring results. God is always going to honor you. God is going to bless you. God is going to allow you to overcome any problem that you're going to have to face in your life. And, you know, after 10 days of eating vegetables, there's not going to be a real noticeable difference on your face. I don't believe that there's any natural reason for this. This was God blessing them. Verse 16 and 17. "Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. And as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." And this is talking about every facet of learning that they had to learn. This is talking about the language of Babylon. I believe that God gave them an ability to learn it fluently within a short period of time. It's talking about math, and it's talking about history and speaking and manners and politics and administration and astronomy and architecture and religion, you name it. Every facet, God gave them wisdom. Now, there's a very important lesson here, is that when you hold on to God's word and when you seek God faithfully in prayer, often God will bring light to you in other areas of your life as well. You might have a secular job. And if you're walking humbly before God, leaning on God, trusting in God, you'll find that often God will just give you favor. He'll show you how to do the job properly. He'll bless your hands. He'll make you a good carpenter. He'll make you a good electrician because you're walking with Him. He'll just bless you with favor. And not only that, but Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. This young man began to be used remarkably by God, and undoubtedly he received and actually interpreted, I think, probably many visions and many dreams that are not even recorded in the book of Daniel throughout his long, lengthy lifetime. Okay, verse 18. "Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar." But here's the big trial. Here's the end of the duration of 3 years. Verse 19. "And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king." So it's like Nebuchadnezzar, he probably examined them very closely now, probably talked to them. He's surveying all the candidates right now, and he's observing them, how they handle themselves. He's watching how they stand there. Are they nervous? Are they fidgeting around? Are they speaking with halting speech when they talk in the Babylonian language? And he's probably quizzing them about their backgrounds and where they'd come from, and he's probably checking them as far as the extent of their knowledge and their personality, and he's looking at their personal appearance, and immediately four stood out. And is it just sheer coincidence that it was the four that made this commitment? No. God gave them great favor. And verse 20, "And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus." Well, that's pretty remarkable, because these magicians and astrologers, they were venerable old skinny sages that had bent over shriveled backs with long white flowing beards, 60, 70, 80 years old, that had studied all the holy books of the Babylonians, and all of a sudden these young teenagers, 16 years old, 17 years old, are 10 times better than they are. And what that is saying is that when you are trained in the school of God, God can make you wiser. God can bless you more. Now, this is not in an egotistical way, but God can often bless you more than the learned doctors of the law, than the learned philosophers of the world, than the learned psychologists that are trying to analyze the human psyche. I think that often God's people that are in touch with Him and walking in Him, they see a lot more than these PhDs that are walking around at a university. Now, they might not know everything about every single little cell and the amoebas and paramecians and everything, but as far as life in general, they see more and perceive more and understand more and are wiser before God than, let's say, like psychologists and others that don't know God. Look at the political realm. I wish a lot of our politicians would pack up their suitcases and go back home again, because really what they're not doing is running the country effectively. It's like you read the decisions they make, and really your mind reels. How can someone be so ignorant? How can someone be so foolish? How can someone do such dumb things? They're dumb. And God often will give us insight into the affairs of the world, and like to us it's so crystal clear what to do, how things should be run, how affairs should be governed. And the reason why is that God has blessed you with knowledge and light and wisdom. Now, not in an egotistical way, but in a proper sense, you have a proper outlook on things, and they do not have that. They do not understand that. They do not look at things the way you do. Well, chapter 2, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to read down to chapter 2, and then we're going to get to some real key verses here tomorrow, but let me start reading chapter 2. Most of the chapter is real clear, real easy to follow. Chapter 2, verse 1, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. In other words, he woke up in the middle of the night and said, goodness, what was this type of dream? He was troubled about it. And who does he turn to but the worldly philosophers first? And that's the way the world will always do it. They'll run to their psychiatrist before they'll come to you. It says in verse 2, then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. Oh boy, glory time for them. They can now interpret the dream of the king. All the king has to do is utter the dream, and they can come up with some type of interpretation. And even if they don't know the interpretation, they can all get together and concoct one. And the king will never know the difference. But there's a little problem here. Verse 3, and the king said unto them, I've dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, that is in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. Standing there, rubbing their hands together in glee. Verse 5, then the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Well, all of a sudden, they don't have even the dream to work with. Now what are they going to do? This is what you call a real extremity. This is a real difficult situation to be in. So they say this. Well, I'll skip verse 6. They say, verse 7, then they answered again and said, let the king show his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. They're now sweating. They're now fidgeting before him. The king answered in verse 8 and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain the time because you see the thing is gone from me. And he says, all right, you're just employing the old tactic of delay. You're trying to buy time now. And so he goes on and he says in verse 9, if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. You have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed, that is, until the situation changes. Therefore, tell me the dream and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. See, what he's reasoning by, he's thinking that if the gods can give them the interpretation, surely the gods can give them the dream as well. And the dream had fled his mind. He could not remember what the dream was. And he knew that he'd recognize it if he would hear it again. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Well, they're saying that in ignorance because there's a little man, little child called Daniel that can tell exactly what the dream is. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean, and it's a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with the flesh. So really, they have one simple plea, and that's be reasonable. Be reasonable, Nebuchadnezzar. There's no one that can fulfill this calling. There's no one around that can ever interpret your dream for you. We all look at the result of all this. Verse 12. For this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Well, we'll see the confidence with which Daniel ministered. And Daniel shrugs his shoulders and says, no big deal. Haul me before the king. I'll interpret. I'll tell him what the dream is and the interpretation thereof. Yeah, the theremin. Yeah, that's, yeah. I passed that roll book around, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah.